Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
So our speaker tonight is Travis, and do you have a title for your talk tonight?
Accepting Suffering.
Accepting Suffering. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you, Diane. Good evening.
Good evening.
I was saying that the Canando priests talk regularly, and at one discussion recently, someone said that they wanted to hear more substantial Dharma talks. And the way my mind works is I tend to poke holes in something like that right away. Like, substantial, I mean, this is a Dharma talk. It's different than that. But it kind of stuck in my mind as there was something there, and I had been thinking about that because it seemed important to this person, and I've thought a lot about it, what that might be, what this person meant by that. You know, we have our practice, and it's founded on Zazen. And you've probably heard that the talks are often viewed as extra, like something we do to encourage sitting, and there to support the practice. But maybe you've also heard that Zazen is good for nothing. or, you know, another way of saying the same thing is we can never gain anything from it. So I think what this priest and friend might have meant by a substantial talk was actually a desire to hear a talk from a person with substance, or at least that the appearance of having substance. And so what I think that could be is more of a feeling, which could be based on a talk without something extra. Like, I don't want to talk about something tonight that you don't need to understand me. I want you to understand what I'm going to talk about tonight, which is absent of frills or something that's more of a trifle or curiosity, because it's easy for me to spend time explaining some relative detail, and that can sometimes feel habitual. So with Zen, we have the foundational teachings of the Buddha, and we have many, many sutras that have been written by ancestors that go back thousands of years. But as long as we're alive, we never cease being a Zen student in the world we live in today. We normally think of study as enrolling in a class, taking a test, passing a class perhaps, or some kind of credential or degree. But our study includes our experience, involves our teacher, and our continuous effort. That's it. We never acquire something, though our confidence and our experience may grow over time. In the origin story of the Buddha, which I'm sure you've all heard, it's not what the Buddha saw in the world, or some special insight that was unique or revealing. It was his response to it. So we study to eliminate delusion. And why do we delude ourselves? We delude ourselves to avoid our own suffering. And so what that means is in our studies, our suffering is there with us. We're intimate with it. With practice, we slowly learn to accept that suffering, even though we'll never understand it fully. And just the giving up of trying to understand takes practice. Our delusions are very strong. And it may seem futile to keep addressing our deluded selves with such limited means as our practice. But with time, it's a very powerful force. Still, it can seem like we're foolish at times. Our minds have to persist through feelings of feeling like this is futile. And this effort, these little efforts, are heroic. This close relationship to our own suffering does not mean delusion ceases, but with practice, the view gets better. This is like turning around and finding a beautiful view that you did not know was there, a more natural view of things just as they are. But just looking at our suffering at first is very difficult. Understanding suffering is not the main activity. But suffering may arrive, it may surprise, and often overwhelm us. Our suffering is the consequence of many events and conditions, some causal, some random, but mostly unknown. Our relationships with our suffering are intimate. They include our family, our friends, our circumstances in life, and the habits we've long formed. We'll never determine the origin or extent of suffering or entirely extinguish delusion. The acceptance of suffering, your own and those around you, is like to pull yourself out of the pit of a conditioned existence. That pit is a place where delusory thoughts never cease for long enough for you to see a path out, for a path to appear. And this is not some special work for some serious Zen student either. Anyone can do it. It starts with a simple intention to avoid being picky. When someone's suffering, they can be very difficult to be around, of course. That picky, prickly behavior can seem unacceptable or unbearable, not okay. Maybe we aren't doing so well ourselves with this easily adopted attitude, this reactive attitude. Maybe we feel we need some support in our lives just to keep going. I often do. Some conditions or laying out of ground rules to avoid all hell breaking loose. This maintaining a semblance of control. The control is another delusion, by the way. But This is where fear and anxiety often arrive. To face our suffering in these circumstances is to grow in the moment. That's an opportunity. When there isn't such an intense situation, you know, there are many ways to distract ourselves. Our favorite people, the memories we cherish, activities we excel at. We can spend most of our time, most of our lives, moving on to the next thing. But here, we start with minimizing distraction so we can face our suffering. Often new people show up in the Zendo not because something difficult already happened to them, but because they are beginning to sense they aren't going to get something they expected. Maybe some achievement. So I think they come oftentimes because they know they need that support. And I say that because this facing yourself, accepting your life, this is difficult but not necessary to do by yourself. And with the Sangha, a newcomer can easily learn that meditation is not just meditation and practice is not just some sensible new choice to take in life. That it's something bigger, something more. Most people don't do this. Most people don't make that choice. There's a lot of momentum in everyday life to just keep moving on to the next thing. Science, our scientific endeavors, our culture of science is surrounding what is in many ways a reliable guide for us, for certain things. I think in my last talk, I was talking about a means to make energy without some new toxic byproduct, and I was excited about that. Maybe I didn't say that my fear is that the planet will be stressed into a much less habitable environment. Not immediately, but in the future. And every one of us on some level thinks about human flourishing as a good thing, I think, almost everyone. And when I was younger, I thought the ideas around human flourishing and humanism were uncomplicated. I don't think so. I don't think they're so uncomplicated now. And the reason I bring this up is Buddhism considers unintended consequences even before I did, but it considers it from a place of nothingness. It considers it from not a scientific materialistic worldview. I feel that human planning is advancing at a pace that is changing our culture rapidly. And we're taking more unified steps as a unified collective. So nature, the natural world on Earth as it is right now, or nature as it was at some ideal time, may be part of what we work on to either preserve or remedy. And we have maybe just an apparent risk to that abundance of nature that we've in the past not had to think so much about. We're increasingly using science to address those problems and those questions. But spiritual practice is amenable to coexisting with all that. Because to think or care about some large arc of humanity or some distant future where the earth we leave flourishes may coexist within us and some immediate concern we have in our life. We're not unified selves in that way. So in practice, we're leaping clear of that abundance and lack. When we sit, maybe that's the first thing we let go of. Those concerns about how we feel about the world and its future, they are still our concerns. They can be intense. But there's also it within us, love, loss, greed, anger, heartbreak, and loneliness. In my experiences, those are the last things to leave. Arriving into the Zendo for the first time, I experienced a physical simplicity. That scientific perspective of a detached observer almost immediately discarded. I learned what a place of practice is from others, from some of you. Moving silently, my first experiences with the forms. Forms that support practice, forms which hold my disjointed and deluded self. In the presence of a teacher, an experienced practitioner provides stability and direction. That time, still my time here, is primarily organized around Zazen and extends only to worldly concerns during social time. I didn't have any special jobs. I hope this sounds okay, but I know that I could take time to work on that, just like I could work on, you know, the parking lot lights. That's always there. But when there's none of that, this simple practice of being in the Zendo, sitting Zazen, offers really the opportunity for people to transform themselves. And so I'm very appreciative of this place as a source of stability in my life. And when I meet someone who's not appearing steady or stable either, it's an opportunity, even in the difficulty. You know, even when we have our social time here, there's really no formal agenda. When we have our practice up front, we're always sitting first and then talking. And so I think it helps reinforce the forms as well. I feel the recovery in myself of something human-sized and something that accords with nature in myself. Forms that aren't oriented towards this feeling that humans need to develop and maintain their own world. Right? So we say nature, we say we're connected with nature, but these concerns that we think about today, with the health and the concerns about the world, I ask you to consider that you can leave that when you walk into the Zendo. You can let that go. It doesn't make you less socially conscious. Because we have to have that ability to reconnect with ourselves. The tendency to be outwardly observing can be eased for a bit. Is the world a better place when more people practice? Not important to answer that. And when you sit, what you may discover is unique. In this sense, the stories of the old masters aren't always helpful. We're all able to practice to make an intention to come more fully into our own lives. So, again, it's not a kind of book learning that I was familiar with before I came. I'm almost completely ignorant of most of the scriptures and sutras. But I had a thirst for knowledge when I came that's mellowed. I still know it would be beneficial to know more, but I don't feel a craving to learn or a shame about my ignorance. I kind of see a wealth and a privilege to having such an extensive tradition. Fondness towards the ancestors, appreciation for all of the devotion that they had. So day by day, with uncounted corrections, sitting, bowing, greeting one another, listening, walking, eating, chanting, and breathing, we're slowly practicing forms in this way too. The self-study that extends continuously through the day, through moment-to-moment awareness. And if I find I'm full of myself or an idea, there's a way back to an awareness that's less prickly than that. An opportunity in the moment to rediscover the beginning of the story I was telling myself. We have lots of stories to examine. That's the nice way of saying delusion. Examine the situation they arise in. Forget about some special insight without any fuss. But that's a blessing, actually, to forget. But because we fuss about things, we sometimes don't think we have room in our lives to practice, when there's actually plenty of room. And I think it's just that we think where it goes isn't where it goes. And where it goes isn't where we think it is. There's plenty of room, because it's more about coexisting and doing what we can and expressing it in our own unique way. The forms are suggestions. The schedule is there to support you. You know, studying with my teacher all those years was to experience firsthand how, with practice, concentration developed over a long time presents itself. I see it as composure. They're here. Regardless of the situation, things come up varied, sudden, but the teacher provides a firm presence. Such a simple quality. Not easy, but simple. You know, I may want many things, but to be in touch with a composed person helped me a lot. As we grow more independent, which we have to, because all help is temporary, we grow in seeing the ways in which we ourselves cultivate this quality. You know, not so long from now, we will die. And what we are doing today then becomes a primary concern. Buddhism will be fine. Kanendo is well established. It's our zazen that puts us into direct contact with what is real for us. What is real is not necessarily what we call reality. Once we begin talking about reality, it's very easy to distort what was originally real. Whatever was real can easily escape. And to be an arbiter of reality is almost as regrettable as being an exemplar of practice. So just quietly do what we can do that honors reality by itself. Sometimes what is appropriate may require some shift or demonstration. If it's a regressive situation, maybe a remonstration. If it's habitual, maybe contemplation. But usually, if we're paying close attention to what's happening, a suggestion or even a cue right on time is most beneficial. So to cultivate a certain sedateness in our relationships, the gentleness which includes our suffering, which contains our suffering, will lead us to a way of life that's more sane. The wisdom inside each of us is ready to bloom at any moment. So, substance, how to refer to our own experience, how to refer to the culture, how much to refer to other cultures and times. But if I ever skip past the first noble truth for myself, I'll suffer from my aversion to suffer. The Dogen line that first touched my heart when I first read it was, "In aversion, weeds spread, and in attachment, blossoms fall." When we're young, we go to school. We learn something about how to live a good life. But as we gain experience and add skills, refinement is continual. Gentle, engaged, and consistent practice. May you all be healthy and joyous. May your friends and families be healthy and joyous.
Thinking about how our practice is kind of austere. We face the wall, very quiet. It's for a long period of time. It lends itself to our suffering coming up and looking at it ourselves and seeing ourselves. But meditation has become a very popular thing lately. People do it online. People do it maybe to escape or to feel better, with a much different focus. So can you sort of compare and contrast our kind of meditation and the meditation that other people are doing that is kind of a popular kind of feel-good kind of meditation? What place does that have in our culture?
I've noticed this, change in how it's discussed culturally. The facing the wall, supports our concentration and lessens distraction. And I think an easy question to ask would be like, well, why don't you close your eyes? But the distractions are coming both externally and internally. So there's an element of concentration that the right conditions helps to establish the right conditions and the right habits and the right posture, breathing, etc. Now, sometimes when, you know, this is prior to COVID, but we'd have beginners come and it takes about 15 minutes or so for me to go through meditation for a beginning group. And by the time you talk about how you get onto the cushion and how to sit and, you know, even like how the eyes are, I think it would be easy for someone to see that as austere, and sometimes you see it in their eyes, like they almost don't believe you that you, hey, I just came to find out what this is all about. But when I came, I think I had a lot of, like, it took a lot of willpower for me to come, because I wasn't like, oh, I've got to go see what this Zen thing is all about. Like, it wasn't like a curiosity. I think some people do have that curiosity. My work culture now has a lot more like promotion of meditation as a, I wouldn't say stress reduction, it's more, now it's become less stress reduction and more mental health, mental health technique. But I don't really see it that way. Not to say that you can't meditate and have some relief, of course you can. But if that's what you're doing it for, you'll never stay with the practice, and you'll never, you'll never find that path out of that pit I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And the scriptures and the writings of our ancestors help inspire us that, inspire us to keep going. So I don't see meditation lessening or being a fad. I don't see it lessening in popularity, but we should have some awareness of how it's being viewed outside of our Zendo, because it'll make us more able to greet newcomers and speak appropriately with them, and, you know, because it's really easy to just assume nothing, but that's not skillful. You know, someone who comes in could have already quite a bit of meditation experience, and we should build on that, and we should welcome their experience. It's going to help us grow.
You start with suffering, and, you know, we are here to face and be with our suffering. And it seems that some meditation practices too, I mean, maybe achieve the same end, but it's to escape any kind of difficult feelings or to run away from them.
I don't know how that can be. Although I have heard, you know, that meditation can boost creativity. So maybe if you're waiting for some great insight, you just, you know, maybe don't don't look so much at the stuff, you know, the difficult. It's like composting, right? it can make your garden really nice, but you've got to deal with your stuff. And you know, you get an awareness of the ways in which you're like hurting loved ones, you know. So how do you deal with that, you know? So I think the daily practice is important because it's a natural way to either start or end your day, reset. Okay, what happened here? You're not consciously thinking that. It's just running. and then with time, it's an unconscious buildup of your own awareness. Did that answer your question? Yeah. Any questions online? Philip.
Thank you, Travis. I was really enjoyed your talk, and I was, for me, struck by how it formed a, not exactly a pair, but how it was related to Vanessa's talk last week in a pre-conceptual or beyond intellectual kind of description, but in relation to that sense that your talk gave me, I really like appreciated the distinction between kind of objective or discursive thinking about what one can do, for instance, positively about changing the world or changing oneself, and the what you called the contrast of that, I think, with a spiritual practice, but like these two perspectives. And it seemed like both you and Vanessa are talking about something that's about practice in a way that's that you can't reach without actually doing it or experiencing it, and the sense of it being connected with what you referred to as the first noble truth, the truth that suffering exists, seems to point to that. I'm not making much sense, but there's a feeling that I really appreciated in your talking about these things, and both a down to earthiness about it, and also something really moving kind of, and heartfelt. So thank you so much for your thoughts and your lecture.
Thanks, Philip. Yeah, I enjoyed Vanessa's talk last week too. Yeah, and I think there's so much concern for the world, and I'm concerned that some people have so much concern that they don't take time for themselves. They have fear and anxiety that doesn't have a means to be abated, and things like anger and frustration come in to the point where their ability to come to um, to come to practice and meet people and relate well with people. This seems cultural right now. Maybe it's the pandemic, but I think it's complex. I think that ability to be able to let go temporarily, right? Like, not that you're an uncaring person, but when you sit zazen, that these things fall away, that can be an important experience for people. And so, yeah, I think, you know, you can see how meditation is more important than ever, possibly. To allow for, yeah, these aspects of ourselves, I would say. They're perspectives, but they're also like, they're multifaceted parts of ourselves. Thank you. That brought out something for me.
You mentioned that maybe sometimes the thoughts of saving the world or yep. what needs to happen are can be the first things to drop away in zazen practice, and some of the last things are maybe the more perennial human issues of
yeah.
That was an interesting point.
Yeah, you know, some people say, you know, you won't die wishing you'd worked harder, you know, missed more of your kids' soccer games. You know, it's a blunt way to express something, but it's those things that are nearest to you and most immediate are the things that you can do the most about. And so I think those are the things that tend to fall away, that are most persistent and that fall away last during seated meditation. Yeah.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.